Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest musicals on Broadway, off Broadway, and on screens this holiday season. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Tom Hooper. Not only is he the Oscar-winning director of The King's Speech, but he's also been at the helm of not one, but two major movie adaptations of some of the biggest titles in musical theater. First, Les Miserables, the 2012 film version of the mega musical that won three Oscars, including one for Anne Hathaway's performance as Fantine, and now, Cats, the great big movie musical based on Andrew Lloyd Webber's international smash. How on earth do you make a movie of Cats? Hooper is in the studio with me to tell us. Hi, Tom. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
I am talking to you the morning after your premiere last night. How was it for you?
It was amazing, but it really was a premiere in the sense that, we were sitting there watching the final version of the film for the first time.
Yeah.
But no one else could have seen it because I finished it on Sunday at 8 in the morning after a final 36-hour in a row sort of sprint to the finish line. It was fabulous, but also there was about 10 minutes in, I was like, oh, wow, I am just really watching my film play for the first time at the world premiere, which just kind of struck me as kind of quite a punchy move. But, the fabulous thing for me about it was the kind of response you could only get with an audience in a true cinematic setting, amazing applause at great moments, like in the middle of Jennifer Hudson's song. You were there, you
sure?
Saw,
yes,
and
we all cheered. Obviously,
when Skimbles goes out onto the bridge, and the very first funny thing that happens when Rebel Wilson yawns and covers her mouth, the whole audience laughed, so I kind of started to relax at that moment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And how many audiences have you seen the film in any version with by that point?
Well, no, that's my point. We hadn't tested it because he kind of tested it in the version before we'd done the visual effects.
Right.
I just thought, whatever we learned from it may not be relevant lessons. So, it was only really within very small groups within the people I was working with.
Right.
So it was very exciting to try it out.
Yeah, yeah. And in a sense, your first test audience was the audience for that trailer that went out,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And what that obviously caused a big stir online on both sides, because Cats is a thing that people have strong opinions about. What did you take away from that? And
I mean, I was totally taken aback by the level of reaction. I mean, to become the number one trending Twitter topic in the world for, quite a few hours, maybe even over 24 hours,
yeah,
seemed totally absurd to me. I mean, we were on the front cover of the Guardian newspaper in the UK. I mean, when does the trailer ever get the front cover?
Right.
I think some of the response was kind of so extreme. It was clearly people having fun with it and then fun with the meme. So some of it was quite entertaining. I mean, I think if I took anything from it, the fact that there was any sort of references to it being sort of making anyone feel uneasy was definitely not my intention. So when I, even if people were expressing that in highly exaggerated or slightly comedic ways, that I did think about, and I went right back to the beginning of what my intention had been with the visual effects, and sort of checked the trailer against that, and really the original idea was to use this technology to be able to apply fur and make feline, the actual face of the actor and the actual body of the actor, and it was sort of in support of the original performance. And when I did a kind of analysis of the trailer afterwards, I felt that what had happened is that the actors' faces had got a little too lost in the kind of CGI fur, and that had become too dominant. And actually, what the trailer reaction did was take me back to clarifying my original intention, and that the trailer wasn't quite representing that. And so the work over the summer was a lot of redesign to pair the fur back to reveal the face. Because I suppose if I have a if I have a gift as a director, it's, you know, maybe it's capturing lightning in a bottle with, you know, with certain, when I'm lucky enough to work with great actors, and if you've caught the lightning in a bottle with Ian McKellen or Judi Dench, you know, why on earth would you want to?
You don't want to get in the way with.
So, and you know, you've got to remember that we'd finish shooting the end of March. The trailer had to be ready by June, so you know it was almost 100 shots. So it was a very punchy thing. It was very early to put out that much material. So it was really work in progress. So I think the good thing was it refocused me on what I wanted the film to be, and I think actually the kind of best, well, there are many aspects about last night that were really exciting, but one of the best for me was coming out. People were generally talking about the emotion they felt about how they cried at Jennifer Hudson, or some people cried at Ian McKellen and Gus Thidcat, or they talked about the sense of magic or the beauty of the world, or people were kind of going, oh my God, what kind of dreams do you have if you imagine worlds in this way, and it wasn't really, no one talking about the visual effects, so that was to me a sign that they were in harness to the vision rather than dominating, which was kind of always what I wanted.
Yeah. You have a very long history with cats.
Yes, I do.
Tell us about when you first encountered it.
Well, in fact, I only found this out recently talking to my sister Rachel, who like me, fell in love with what she wanted to do in the world young, and she knew she wanted to be a radio journalist. I mean, she wanted to work in this medium of audio, and in fact, she's a parliamentary correspondent and has been for many years at the BBC. And she had this. On Capital Radio, she had this chance to, as like a kid reviewer, like a 12-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old reviewer, to go and review shows for Capital Radio and kind of give a kid's eye view. And she had been set by Capital Radio to review Cats and came home and said it's fabulous. And so as a result, Mum and Dad took all of us, and I fell in love with it. And I was, I think, eight years old, and I was, you know, I have such vivid memories of that. Of that evening in the theatre and the impact it had on me, and we then bought the audio cassette, which we listened to practically wore out. I mean, every car trip anywhere we listened to Cats. So the songs are deeply ingrained in me, and you know, in many ways I'm this whole thing is about honouring that 8-year-old's experience and trusting in that 8-year-old's experience, and I think if I could go back in a time machine and visit my 8-year-old self and say, one day you're going to direct this as a movie, I would have been completely blown away. And it was a great example of how dreams can come true that you couldn't possibly realize could be dreams at the time. I mean, I didn't sit there going, wow, I'd like, you know, one day I would like to do this as a movie, it would have been absurd. But what's interesting is how vivid my recall is. And for example, you know, there was a debate internally about whether to keep Moments of Happiness, which is Judy singing a little section from the Four Quartets, which is probably the only bit of adult poetry of Eliot's poetry in the piece. And I remember being affected by Brian Blessed singing Moments of Happiness, even though I didn't fully understand it. And I remember specifically the sense that I didn't feel that the show was talking down to me as a child. I felt like I was being taken seriously, almost like as an adult, and it wasn't talking down to me, and it wasn't a kid's show, and I felt a great sense of being allowed to be initiated into a slightly more adult world through Cats. And so when I was defending it, I could specifically remember, well, those words affected me at eight, so you know, because the easy thing would be to go, well, an 8-year-old wouldn't understand it, and there were many things like that where I had a vivid enough recall that I could sort of, almost like that 8-year-old Tom was the kind of toughest critic on me, because I always kept going, well, it has to work for an 8-year-old Tom,
right?
You know, because that's why I fell in love with him.
And what do you have a sense of what is it about it that you were, can you characterize sort of in a broad sense what you were fighting, what you were like making sure translated onto the screen that you remember reacting to so vividly back then?
I think that this sense of being initiated into a community as a kind of special guest, a community that really didn't much care for humans and you know, wouldn't normally let you in, I thought Trevor Nunn and Andrew created very brilliantly a sense of going through a portal into a strange world, which rapidly became a world where you were, you know, at home and made friends with the characters. But that way they use sort of disorientation at the beginning to create permission for their character designs and their way that we viewed cats. And in some ways, you know, the film does a version of sort of, you know, letting you into the world before you realizing they're actually quite a funny tribe of cats.
Right. Yeah. And did you think about full on? I mean, it sounds like you did a little bit because you thought about the idea of like over computer generating somebody's face, you know, digital furring somebody's face. But was full on animation ever on the table? And if it ever was, why did you decide not to? And
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, so the journey as an adult began at the end of Les Mis in I think 2012, when I was walking through Soho. I suddenly thought, oh, you know, it'd be so sad if I never did another musical again, but Les Mis was my first, and I've learned so much about how...
Are you a musical theater guy? Well, like, after Cats, did you go on to be a musical theater
fan?
Funny
enough, my first break as an actor at school was in two musicals, The Beggar's Opera and then Patience by Gilbert and Sullivan. And that's where I fell in love with acting, and I was sort of 10, 11, 12, And so I started in musical theatre, as you could say.
Right.
I mean, equally, I realised by the age of 12 that I wasn't getting the lead roles, so I probably shouldn't pursue the dream of being an actor.
Okay,
I was a weirdly tough 12-year-old who said, you've got to let that dream die now, because otherwise you'll waste years of your life trying to be an actor when you're not good enough. So I was quite kind of clinical about that kind of thing. But I had an amazing teacher called Roger Mortimer, who was... an ex-RSC actor turned English and drama teacher who really inspired me with the love of theatre and drama. And I vividly remember singing Memory in drama class and trying to work out how to kind of express the imagery. And there was, you know, a hilarious moment when I was shooting with Jennifer Hudson where I got a sort of incredibly strong sense of recall of standing in class doing my own version and having a very sort of not so dim awareness that I didn't quite know how to make the lyrics work or make sense of them, and I was trying very hard to picture all these burnt out ends and stuff. anyway, as I was walking through Soho and I thought about, well, what would that musical be, the really special thing about Les Mis was that it had never been adapted for the screen before. I mean as a book Les Mis has been adapted many times, but the musical was unadapted.
Right.
And I thought, well, is there another iconic musical that's never been adapted? And of course Cats, in terms of the big musicals, Cats was rare. Interestingly, Steven Spielberg had optioned it in the mid-90s, and I know he'd had a look at how to do it, and you know, clearly hadn't worked out a way that he was comfortable with proceeding. And I thought, well, maybe the reason it's never been done is because people, you know, couldn't work out what the cats should look like, and maybe the advance of visual effects might have opened a portal or a door to a way of doing it that might make it possible. So it was really that moment where I kind of go, maybe it wasn't made because the technology wasn't there, and maybe the technology's there now. But in answer to your question, I never want to do, I mean, much as I admire The Jungle Book, and in fact I've worked with MPC, who created The Jungle Book and The Lion King, you know, to do Cats. I somehow felt that if they were actually cats in a photoreal sense, it would be really missing the point, because Elliot is clearly talking about humans, he knows as much as cats. He's talking about humans through a feline lens. I mean, you know, clearly McCavity is a play on Sherlock Holmes's Moriarty. Clearly Buster Jones is a play on, you know, old duffers who inhabited the gentlemen's clubs. Clearly Gus the Theatre Cat is full of, steeped with the sense of, you know, a human eye view on the history on the stage, and that's why it resonates with Ian so well. So I thought the hybridization was the point, and to make it either fully human or fully cat would be to kind of entirely miss the point, and to miss the point of Elliot's wit, I think.
Yeah. And what guided you as you made choices with, like, some cats have jackets, some cats have shoes, some cats, like, what was the sort of thought process
weirdly, you know, it was quite tormenting. I mean, it sounds crazy to say tormenting, but because part of me was like, well, you know, should they just all have digital fur? But then I think in the end, I was guided by the show, because in the show, the characters who have songs have elements of clothing, and the chorus didn't. And I thought that was an interesting distinction, and perhaps was a way of me playing homage to sort of Napier's intention through the thing, and possibly it was another way of sort of treading that line between the humanity of the characters and the cat of the characters.
And what did, when you were filming on these, we should say, very elaborate sets with where everything is
oversized.
You know, oversized. What were the actors wearing? What did they look like in the room?
Well, ironically, I mean, having sort of said, you know, we will never do, you know, cats in Lycra.
They were wearing Lycra
because, you know, if you're dancing in a sort of figure hugging suit, it's the best material. They also needed to, you know, have, you know, cabling to do with their sound or their microphone. So it was a good way of doing that. And also I wanted them to wear something where their body shape was incredibly clear, because when you're applying fur, you don't want to be kind of guessing where the line of the body is. You need to get a precise reference to it.
Right. And for Les Mis, you made a very clear choice to have people singing in the room as opposed to singing to a recording that they'd recorded at another time. Did you do the same thing here?
Yeah, it's all live all the time.
Yeah.
There's practically no ADR in it, and I'm very proud of it. And I think even more than Les Mis, I felt, you know, because there was this blending of the kind of virtual and the real, I think it was even more important to me that the singing was live, because it grounded it in the fact that this is live performance and as it is live dance. And what's interesting is 7 years ago, I couldn't do an interview without talking about live singing, and I'm quite cheered that 7 years later it's now just, yeah, he did it all live, and it's sort of no big deal.
We, as most of the listeners will be theater people, and I myself as a theater person so appreciate seeing it. It is so apparent, the difference.
And also, your wonderful audience listening now, I mean, you that's what you do. You sing live every night. It's no great mystery. So.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
That's what you can do, and you'll bring to that.
I'll have more with Tom right after the break. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSmusical.com. I'm back with the director of Cats, Tom Hooper.
So Cats is a dance musical, right? And I mean, the stage show is a dance musical, and the movie I saw last night, the movie that will be released on Christmas, is definitely still a dance musical. I mean, all these people are dancers. And even the people you didn't know were dancers. How do you have a philosophy about shooting dance? Because it can be, you know, there's a tension between close-up and pulling back.
That's such an interesting question. I mean, one of the real excitements about doing Cats was to take on dance as a medium for the very first time. And again, you know, like with Les Mis, I got to take on the musical form the first time. And I realize how lucky I am that, you know, my first dance experience is on this scale, because
right.
I mean, it's very out there. But I always felt, you know, what Gillian Lynn had done was very key to the show.
She's the original choreographer,
And I wanted dance to be a key part of it. And, you know, the reason I've set the film in Soho's West End of London is, to me, well, you know, they're West End cats, they're theatre cats, they're entertainers. I mean, that's what the Jellicle Gang is. But I think the thing that I found so thrilling about working with dancers was to discover how people who can be exceptionally talented in one field can turn out to have incredible talents in others. So, you know, Frankie Hayward, principal of the Royal Ballet, one of the top ballerinas in the world, you know, never acted on the screen before, turns out to be this, you know, utterly gifted natural screen actor with an innate sense of where the camera is and what to do in front of the camera and how to share herself with the camera in a way that, you know, she held herself with Ian McKellen and Judi Dench in front of the film camera, which is unbelievable. I mean, and improbable. And she had that the great gift of an actor, which is there is a secret part of Frankie that is only revealed when the camera's turning over. I mean, you know, when you meet her, you won't gain access to that side. Her best self, there's something very precious in her that's only shared in the actor performance. And the definition of a true performer is someone, I think, who has a best self that can only be visible in the moment of creation, in the moment of the camera rolling or being on stage. And it's a very particular type of person that where that act of sharing only happens in those specific circumstances. So Frankie could sing, you know, and then we've got sort of Robbie Fairchild again, who's got a dance background.
Yeah, Broadway audiences will know him from An American in Paris.
Yeah, you know, who is a great singer and actor, and then Stephen McRae, and you know, I mean, well, he's even more fun because he's, you know, one of the best ballerinas at the Royal Ballet, one of the best ballet dancers at the Royal Ballet. Plus, you know, on the side happens to be like arguably the best tap dancer in the world, and he can sing as well and act. And then on the other hand, you have someone like Laurie Davidson, who is definitely an actor, played Mr. Mistopheles. Yep. You know, we broke with tradition and didn't cast a dancer, but Laurie was going to bar class with Frankie and Robbie every morning, and by the end kind of could hold himself as a dancer, and I even got Judi Dench dancing briefly. So, but in terms of your question about, I mean, it was, you know, how to shoot dance. I don't know if I know the answer. I know I began a kind of conversation with myself about how to do it, and what you're seeing in the film probably is me exploring how to do it. I mean, I think the interesting thing is what I sort of felt is you know, even if you're not from the one point of view of the proscenium, it's still so much about point of view. Like, where you place the camera is the new proscenium, and if you place it in three different angles, effectively you're dealing with three new prosceniums. And sort of it all becomes about, rather than doing it to one point of view, is once you've created something, where's the best place to put the camera in relation to it. And I think the thing that I really didn't expect was I thought I was always going to be like, I just want to be in wide shot because that's the way to film dance. But you know, when you've got Frankie Haber, I mean, think about Frankie when she's dancing on Naming of Cats, doing her solo, and I would have thought that would have just played on head to toe, but you go in close and it's so mesmeric. And also she's dancing with her shoulders, with her upper body, with her fingers, with her hands. So what I got excited by was that there was a way of shooting dance where the dance read through the physicality of the close-up as well as the head-to-toe shot, and that was quite exciting to discover.
Frankie's playing a new character named Victoria, a new cat named Victoria, who is part of a kind of bolstered up, there is more of a plot to this cat than the cats
Thank
that
you.
Was on stage.
That's right.
I mean, the bar was low, let's be honest. But
that's mean. Come on, Gordon.
But no, I know, we love cats. Yeah. But, you know, it's a loosely sort of hung together show, right? Yeah. And this is like, you, I feel like you and your co-writers have worked harder to kind of thread it together stronger and give it up. How did you think about that?
Yeah, I think the biggest change, I mean, Lee Hall, who's been a wonderful collaborator, Lee and I wrote the script, and we had this intensive period sitting in Covent Garden about 3 years ago for 3 weeks doing the first draft of the script together, and literally going out the door and walking Covent Garden, Soho, and saying, well, what if it was here, what if it was there? And I think the first challenge we faced was that in the show, the cats mainly sing out to the audience and explain themselves straight out. Yeah. And obviously, you can't have a movie where every number there's, you know, singing to camera. And there is this character called Victoria the White Cat, who does what's called the White Cat solo in the musical, who's a smaller presence, but it's set Lee and I thinking about whether there was a role for a newcomer, an ingenue, who was going to be our eyes and ears, who was going to sort of stumble into this community of Jellicles and go on this journey of discovery. And then we came up with the idea of, you know, that of Victoria being sort of rather neglectfully abandoned at the top of the film and coming out of, you know, in a wasteland, like the junkyard of the show, and coming out of, or like Elliot's wasteland, coming out of the sack and being in a scary situation and meeting the Jellicles the first time, who initially are predatory but soon can't help themselves to be friendly and funny. So I think reframing it as a kind of as more of a picaresque journey of a new cat through London, meeting these cats more in the tradition of, you know, the everyman stories or the morality plays, or that, you know, that very old-fashioned idea of narrative is journey, that you're physically going on a journey to meet new things, and that is the narrative. All that sort of to guide us, and then it sort of out of that grew this idea that maybe, because, you know, in many ways the film is about, you know, the perils of tribalism and the power of kindness, and this tribe, you know, has people it pushes to its margins. So Grisabella is excluded from the community and is not accepted, and it takes the innocence, the clear-sightedness, and most importantly the compassion of the newcomer coming into this group who doesn't respect or adhere to these judgments and challenges the judgments and gets that community to learn to forgive. And, you know, forgiveness is a theme that runs through so much of my work, right back to my first film, Red Dust, which is about truth and reconciliation in South Africa, you know, all the way to Bertie having to learn to forgive himself for his stammer, or Valjean being forgiven by the priest. And mainly this film, you know, I just want it to be thoroughly entertaining and escapist, but there is a part of me that says it is about the power of acts of kindness, and at this moment, politically in the UK and the US, you know, anything that talks about kindness is good in my book.
And you also sort of embrace magic in a way that, yes, I think is really fits right in with kind of what Cats is.
Well, I mean, the great there is this great moment of magic in the show, without creating a spoiler, of the return of a hero character who's been kidnapped.
Right.
And I think the other big change Lee Hall and I did was to reinvent the character of Mr. Mistopheles. So, yeah. So in the original show, he's played by Wayne Sleep, and he was a deus ex machina cat, you know, who came in a crisis, did an amazing dance, and solved, and conjured up the missing person. And, you know, in film terms, the deus ex machina quality of that arrival felt tricky, and Lee and I just fell in love with this idea of this clumsy apprentice magician who falls in love with Victoria early, and is clearly a klutz, and his journey of, you know, his coming of age as a magician is a sort of parallel plot to, you know, Frankie is Victoria's coming of age as a young cat learning about how to make her mark on this community through her compassion.
Yeah. And you've mentioned Judi Dench a couple of times.
Yes.
She plays Old Deuteronomy, and she somewhat famously was going to be in the original Cats, and then she hurt herself, wasn't.
You know, in a story about resurrection and second chances and new lives, I mean, what you know, how extraordinary to have Judi Dench, who was going to play Grisabella and Jenny Anidos,
yep,
in the original production, who went through all the rehearsals, went through cat school there, Gillian Lynn's cat school.
Yeah, right.
Got to a week before opening and broke her ankle. And then Trevor Nunn said, don't worry, you can't play Jenny Anidos. You know, I think she broke her ankle when she was doing Jenny's tap number.
Yeah.
But you can still play Grisabella. And then I think in preview she fell off the stage as Grisabella. She finally surrendered. And to come to her, I went down to her place in the country and come to her, almost 40 years later, and go, would you come back and be the star of Cats? Was, you know, I could tell she was moved by it. And also for me, you know, to regender Old Deuteronomy as a woman, you know, I come from a family where my mother's been a great sort of creative influence on my life. She's a writer, and she's a great thinker and a collaborator of mine. And in some ways, I'm sort of honouring my mother's influence on my work by regendering Old Deuteronomy and saying the God of Cats can be a woman, and certainly in 2019 should be a woman.
Yeah.
And Judi, you know, and Judi, I've wanted to work with Judi for decades. I mean, she's such a genius, and finally to be on set with her, and she's everything you wanted to be, and just the way, even watching it last night, the way the film settles another level the moment she arrives, and, you know, she lends a brilliant, to use the word magic in a different way, she lends a brilliant magic to it and anchors it brilliantly. It was a joy. And that moment of filming Gus the Theatre Cat with Ian singing really to Judi about his life in the stage. And there was Ian in his 80th year, starting on his one-man show, which was a year-long show about reminiscing, his reminiscences of a life in the theatre, right, to playing to Judy in her 84th year in a cat basket. And then McKellen I saw playing Coriolanus when I was 10. And again, I've wanted to work with him for decades. So that, for me as a director, you know, that was very, very special.
You mentioned on the stage, you were standing on the stage last night at Alice Tully Hall at the premiere, you know, next to your extremely starry cast. And you mentioned that the first person you called was Taylor Swift. Yeah. Why?
Because I, she had auditioned for Les Mis and for Eponine. I think she's talked about this, so I can now talk about it too. And Anne was really brilliant in the audition. But in the end, it was hard to understand that if, you know, Taylor Swift being Eponine, it'd be kind of hard to understand Eponine being overlooked by Marius at all.
Right. I
thought it would slightly undermine the logic of the narrative. So she didn't get it for the best possible reason.
Right.
But I'd always kind of, you know, I'd known she was interested in acting, and so it was just kind of I just thought, God, I wonder whether she has any curiosity, and I. In my ignorance, also didn't realise she has this great passion for cats, the animal, as well as the show. I reached out to her in January and we met up, and I went through my vision for it, and I had this sort of precious 10-second clip of what an actor might look like as a cat, which she loved, and she's been a great supporter. And then, you know, with her there was this really unexpected dimension. I mean, she was cast to play Bomberina and sing McCavity, and
yeah.
And she went round to Andrew's house to, I think, to rehearse McCavity or just have a sing through. And Andrew played her the new song for Victoria. And she immediately started to hear lyrics in her head. And over the course of the weekend, you know, wrote these really quite beautiful lyrics. That to me, I was very moved by, because I mean, I was sort of into production by this point, and it was as if someone had come in, gone on set, spent time with the actors, looked at what I was shooting and sort of reflected back to me what I was trying to do, but in words far more articulate than I could have possibly come up with. And you know, I don't want to embarrass her, but to write lyrics that sit in a T.S. Eliot world is, I think, a phenomenal achievement. Because when you watch it, you know, it feels completely of that language. So she's a truly brilliant wordsmith, and she also worked with Andrew on the music, and then was on the floor with me at the monitor when Frankie, you know, started to sing the song, and so that aspect of the collaboration was very special.
Yeah. You've been working on this film for, you know, years now, and it is soon to be released. What's on your plate after this?
I have literally no clue. Because, I've been so intensive on this, I haven't even wanted to think about it. Probably a holiday would be a good start.
You directed a couple of episodes of His Dark Materials,
yes,
right,
yeah,
for HBO.
Yeah.
Will you do more of that in the coming seasons, do you know?
I was always happy to go back and do more. It was really fun to sort of set the world up for the first 2 hours and to do the casting.
Right, because you did the first two episodes. That's right.
Yeah, and I thought Daphne Keane was such an exciting discovery. It's been interesting to have a year or a couple of years. I shot it last summer. Talking about our relationship to our animal selves in two different ways. In Dark Materials, you know, our soul is externalized as in animal form as a demon, and you know, when you have conversations with your inside your head and you know, there's a part of your head that speaks back,
right.
It's like the demon is the part of you that answers back, so right. And cats, I suppose, is you know, about the sort of fantasy of being your favorite animal, or it reconnects us with our animal roots, or the part of us that is still locked in our animal memory and past. So it's been kind of an interesting thing to do in tandem.
Yeah. And what's the next musical for you?
Good question.
I mean, if you're going on the sort of you know, mega musical from a certain era. I mean, there's Phantom. You could do a Phantom. You could redo the Phantom.
I think I'm really drawn. I'm particularly drawn to musicals that have never been done because that's the fun. Because I mean, particularly if a musical's been done in an iconic way, I feel like why do you need to do it? But this is So let's see.
Do you have any interest in directing for the stage? Anything on stage?
Yeah, I do. I mean, when I was at Oxford, I directed theatre. I did A View from the Bridge with Kate Beckinsale starring in it.
Oh, wow.
He was a student with me, and Kafka's The Trial and the Stephen Berkoff adaptation with Emily Mortimer and Eve Best.
Oh, wow. So you've been working with great actors all your life, is what you're saying.
And, so, yeah, I'd, at the right moment, I'd love to come back to the stage and do something, yeah.
Well, we look forward to seeing what it is when it happens.
Thanks,
Thank you, Gordon. Tom. Thanks for being here. Congratulations. Happy opening.
Thanks, Gordon. Yeah.
That was Tom Hooper, the director of Cats, in movie theaters December 25th. If you like what you've heard on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd so appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. Coming up, Stagecraft is taking a couple of weeks off for the holidays, but I'll be back January 7th with another new episode. Until then, happy holidays, and see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.